Good evening. A vaccine is approved in the United Kingdom, Trump's war on social media, and the end of the war on drugs. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. Republicans and Democrats in Congress remain unable to reach agreement on fresh relief for a pandemic-hit U.S. economy on Wednesday, with top Republicans supporting what the Senate's top Democrats dismissed as an inadequate partisan proposal. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said outgoing Republican President Donald Trump supported a proposal put forth by Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell after McConnell on Tuesday rejected a $908 billion bipartisan package. Meanwhile, things are moving faster on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. British officials have become the first to authorize Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use. Eileen Alfandary reports.
British Health Secretary Matt Hancock said Britain expects to begin receiving the first shipment of 800,000 doses within days, and people will begin receiving shots as soon as the National Health Service gets the vaccine.
From next week, we'll be able to start rolling this out. We'll start with those who are most vulnerable to coronavirus, and it will. You need two jabs, so 21 days apart. And after that, we will start protecting people as the protection comes with these two jabs.
Hancock said nursing home residents, people over 80, and healthcare workers and other care workers will be the first to receive the shot. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration will consider approving the Pfizer vaccine after a meeting next week. An advisory panel to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says U.S. healthcare workers and nursing home residents should be first in line when the initial doses of the coronavirus vaccine becomes available, most likely later this month. The two groups total about 24 million people. Dr. Jose Romero chairs the CDC panel. He told CNN the panel will meet again tomorrow and begin to consider which group should be the next to receive vaccines when doses become available for them, most likely early next year.
And the next groups that we have scheduled for discussion are essential workers, those workers that keep our society going, and that includes postal workers, that includes individuals in meatpacking plants, grocers, things like that. Then other groups are individuals 65 and older, and those persons with multiple comorbidities, multiple conditions that we know are associated with adverse outcome if you're infected with COVID.
As the virtual meeting got underway, one panel member noted that on average, one person is dying of COVID-19 per minute in the U.S. right now. The outbreak has killed more than 270,000 people, with deaths, hospitalizations, and cases rocketing in recent weeks. A near record 2,600 people died yesterday. It was the second deadliest day of the pandemic in this country. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
And court documents released today show the Justice Department investigated evidence of a bribery for pardon scheme potentially involving the White House. The August 28th court opinion granted prosecutors access to confidential emails along with other evidence. They were apparently scrutinizing two individuals as unregistered lobbyists. A related scheme involved cash for a pardon or reprieve from a defendant in the Federal Bureau of Prisons custody at some point. The Justice Department had asked to keep the ruling secret because it identifies both individuals and conduct that have not been charged by the grand jury. White House spokesperson Kayleigh McEnany.
The DOJ official said yesterday that no government official was or is currently a subject or target of the investigation disclosed in this filing.
Trump has granted 29 pardons and commuted 16 people's sentences during his presidency. Last week, Trump pardoned his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, for lying to the FBI. Undisclosed lobbying for Turkey and potential related prosecutions Flynn could have faced in the future. And Trump has again threatened to veto this year's defense policy bill. This time, if lawmakers don't meet his last-minute demand to include language to overhaul the tech industry's prized liability shield, Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. The president, often accused of governing by tweet, has been enraged by what he considers unfair treatment by Twitter and Facebook. Both platforms have been regularly tagging Trump's blitz on the election, claiming without evidence the presidency was stolen from him. White House spokesperson McEnany says there's a double standard for conservatives.
The president is serious about it. And I noted, you know, when you have other world leaders that are making calls for genocide and Twitter not finding that worthy of flagging or blocking. Beyond that, you look at China, who's putting out disinformation. China tweeted out, I believe it was 6 days ago, I think it was November 25th, that COVID-19 did not originate in Wuhan, something that was not deemed worthy of flagging by Twitter. There are real grave concerns here, and the president stands by that.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer blamed Trump for using his office for personal revenge against his perceived enemies.
The president's reportedly asking his staff whether he can issue preemptive pardons for himself, his family members, Rudy Giuliani. There's a simple answer, no. No, Mr. President, that would be a gross abuse of the presidential pardon authority. But I have a more important question. Just how long are our Republican colleagues going to indulge the president in this nonsense? Many of our Republican colleagues gave the president space to contest the validity of our elections, poisoning Americans' faith in our democracy. Now he's threatening to veto a pay raise for our troops and considering preemptively pardoning the entire Trump family. When are our Republican colleagues in the Senate going to say enough already? At the very least, with the respect to the defense bill, Senate Republicans ought to find the courage to ignore the president's 11th hour ramblings and pass the NDAA.
Senator Chuck Schumer, Trump has targeted a provision of the Communications Decency Act called Section 230. It was included in the expansive law passed under the Clinton administration to protect emerging tech companies from being held liable for other people's posts. Trump has called it corporate welfare. Axios was first to report that Senate Republicans were trying to improvise a proposal to change Section 230 short of a wholesale repeal. The executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation is Cindy Cohen. She says Section 230 protects more than big tech companies.
It also protects you when you forward an email that you might receive from a friend to another friend. You're not responsible for what that person says. It's a pretty basic idea. You know, it makes people responsible for their own words, but not responsible for the words of others if they're providing a communications mechanism. The reverse of this is if you were responsible for every time you emailed something, you know, you got something from your mom and it wasn't right and you emailed it to a bunch of other friends and you were responsible for it, people wouldn't speak so much. And certainly no one would start a platform where essentially they are responsible for what every single person says on the platform and could be sued for it.
So we wouldn't have Facebook, Twitter, or anything like that.
Yeah, because it is a specific rule for the online world. It's different for, say, a newspaper in its offline version than for a newspaper in its online version. Now, the New York Times has comments. They're not responsible for what people put in the comments. They are responsible for what goes into the letters to the editor. And this was because Congress recognized that the online world was different and that more people were going to be able to join the conversation online.
Why was it put in there, and why is President Trump so angry?
There's no evidence that big tech companies are censoring conservatives. I mean, anyone who's looked at this, you know, as a matter of like data and information has not found that there's any slant in the way that content moderation works for these companies that disfavors conservatives. As a factual matter, that's not true. Trump is mad that Twitter has put some things on his messages indicating that he's spreading falsehoods. He wants to punish Twitter for that, or maybe Facebook as well, though Facebook does less of it. The problem with that, first of all, the internet is not just those tech giants. And Section 230, it protects many, many more things that you do online than just Facebook. It protects Wikipedia when you go online. It protects you when you forward an email. It protects so much bigger than just the tech giants. The harms that could happen here are much wider than President Trump's interest in harming a few big companies that he's mad at.
Now, I was listening to the hearings a while back, and the president of Twitter, maybe they would have to revisit 230. Was he just saying
that?
Yeah,
well, I think that, you know, Facebook would love a world in which only Facebook could post other people's speech because nobody else could afford it. if you're going to make people liable for it, rich people can absorb that liability and poor people can't. Facebook could be okay, but the next Facebook won't be able to happen. We'll be stuck with Facebook forever if we create this liability. The current tech giants are rich enough that they could probably manage this. And what would happen with Facebook isn't that it would absorb the liability. It's just that you'd try to post something on Facebook and you'd probably have to wait a day or two for them to make sure it was okay before you got to post, right? You get a little message saying, you know, we're evaluating your post and we may put it up in a day or two if it meets our standards, but otherwise we won't. People who are concerned about the power of the tech giants who talk about getting rid of Section 230 immunity, to me, are being very short-sighted, right? This is not how this is going to work. We're going to lose the Internet Archive. We're going to lose Wikipedia. We're going to lose them. But I think the big companies will just put in massive filtering systems and nobody will be able to say anything that's controversial. Certainly not going to be able to do any political organizing, work to protect democracy, any of that kind of work.
It's like China?
Certainly. China is a place where there is a lot of limitations on what people can say because of the government pressure on platforms. That's how it works.
The debate right now, and what do you expect from a Biden administration?
The Biden administration has said it wants to look at 230 as well for very different reasons. I kind of hope that President Trump's lashing out here will help wake up some of the Democrats who think that reforming 230 is the answer to their concerns about tech giants and get them to see just how dangerous that would be. My hope is that the Biden administration folks will look at what's happening here with President Trump and see that their embrace of reforming Section 230 might be a wrong and dangerous step, and they should look other places to rein in the tech giants.
Less controlled by strongmen at the top and more democratically.
Exactly. The answer to dictatorships is not to try to make the dictator nicer. It's to get rid of dictatorships.
Cindy Cohen is executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The fight over Section 230 complicates predictions that lawmakers were days from finishing the $740.5 billion defense authorization bill that cements decisions about troop levels, new weapon systems, and military personnel policy. President-elect Joe Biden's choice of Secretary of State Antony Blinken and potential choice for Secretary of Defense Michelle Flournoy are facing a chorus of criticism from progressives. On Monday, five progressive organizations, Code Pink, Our Revolution, Progressive Democrats of America, RootAction.org, and World Beyond War, released a statement opposing Flournoy as Defense Secretary. The statement says, Michelle Flournoy should not be put in charge of the Pentagon, and we are prepared to launch a major nationwide grassroots campaign demanding that she not be confirmed. A Bernie Sanders delegate to the 2020 Democratic National Convention, peace activist Marcy Winograd, wrote the letter. She says Biden is continuing policies friendly to the military-industrial complex.
I'm concerned that we are doubling down on that and that this is a far more dangerous era in which the top pick in line to be Secretary of Defense, Michelle Flournoy, is openly advocating that we need to escalate the arms race so that we can fight and prevail in a war against nuclear China, home to 1.3 billion people, the largest world exporter and holder of U.S. debt. This is a very scary conversation that Michelle Flournoy has been having with members of Congress to gin up a Cold War that threatens to spawn multiple hot wars in the waters of China and North Korea.
What's the difference between them and Donald Trump's approach?
Obviously, he went and met with the leader of North Korea. That came under criticism from the right wing of both parties. But now we are facing a potential Secretary of Defense who is calling for escalating troop deployments to East Asia. To me, this is insanity. We need a Secretary of Defense who is going to work with our Secretary of State to join every possible peace and global cooperation treaty. Michelle Flournoy is down with the jacking up the arms race by investing in artificial intelligence, robotic warfare, every science fiction image that you can conjure up of warfare for the future. She's all for that.
People who supported Bernie Sanders expected that because of the progressives' help in getting elected against Trump, that they would get something out of this. And are they getting listened to at all? Is this a bad dream?
It is a bad dream, Paul. It's a nightmare, really. There have been a couple of exceptions to his appointments. I think Janet Yellen for Treasury is one of them. But by and large, these are abysmal appointments or nominations that we need to push back very hard on. There should not be any honeymoon. The left, progressive, not just the left or progressives, anyone who believes in a reasonable investment of taxpayer money needs to shout to the heavens and say, this is not okay. This will bring us right back to Donald Trump or somebody worse in 2024.
If there's anything that could be learned from Trump is that people are tired of these wars.
Trump is not a pacifist and that he has...
He's a liar. I know he's a liar, but people believed his lies at first.
Yes, they did believe their lies and some still do. And that's something that we have to be very truthful about. He is not our answer to ending imperial domination with 800 military bases in 80 countries and wars that we launched that never seem to end. Joe Biden, Antony Blinken, his nominee for Secretary of Defense, who is a hawk from day one, to say this is wrong. This is the wrong path for us to follow. Several organizations, including Code Pink, Roots Action, Our Revolution, Progressive Democrats of America, Roots Action, World Beyond War, have launched a letter to say, Joe Biden, no, we do not want Michelle Flournoy. We don't want any war profiteers leading the Pentagon, running the Pentagon. On the subject of war profiteering, I want to point out that Michelle Flournoy knows this scam inside out. After she left the Pentagon, she served under both Clinton and Obama. She went to Boston Consulting and expanded their military contracting business by $30 million.
Is the honeymoon over between progressive and mainstream Democrats?
I don't know that there was ever a honeymoon. I think that maybe there was a detente for a moment to rid us of Trump and his authoritarianism that was such a danger to this country. But we need to be as vigilant as we were in opposing Trump, in opposing Biden's rush to military interventionism.
Peace activist Marcy Winograd is a Bernie Sanders delegate to the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Reportedly, other contenders for Secretary of Defense are emerging, including retired Army General Lloyd Austin and Jed Johnson, who served as the Pentagon's top lawyer and then as head of the Department of Homeland Security during President Barack Obama's second term. Both Austin and Johnson are black. An historic vote at the United Nations today finally recognized the medicinal value of cannabis, a plant that's been used therapeutically for thousands of years. After a recommendation from experts at the World Health Organization, the UN's Commission for Narcotic Drugs voted to remove cannabis from a list of drugs previously judged to have little medical benefit. However, it still remains a banned drug for non-medical use under UN law. The vote to remove cannabis from Schedule 4 of the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs was narrowly won by 27 to 25 votes, with the United States, the United Kingdom voting for the change, and Russia heading a block of countries, including China, Pakistan, and Nigeria, which were against the move. Currently, more than 50 countries worldwide have adopted medicinal cannabis programs. Canada, Uruguay, and 15 U.S. states have legalized recreational use, with Mexico and Luxembourg close to becoming the third and fourth countries to do so. Last month, five more states legalized or decriminalized marijuana in the United States by large margins, greater than either presidential candidates, even in conservative states, showing a growing bipartisan agreement in polarized times. One out of three Americans now lives in a state where marijuana is legally available. One state, Oregon, long ago legalized pot and raised the bar in November by legalizing all drugs, including heroin, the first in the nation, although several other countries, including Portugal, have done the same. The director of the Open Society Global Drug Policy Program is Cassia Malinowska. She says legalizing pot is good, but...
What's even greater news is actually the state of Oregon, who as the first in the country passed a ballot initiative on decriminalization. When we talk about decrim, we often refer to Portugal, we refer to Czech Republic.
Why do we refer to those countries?
Decrim there has been in place for a number of years and we have a lot to learn from it. But there was no example that we can point to in the United States. So I'm really excited that Oregon is going to provide the evidence that we need for decrim to be considered by other states and also at some point by U.S. Congress. Oregon is actually making two commitments. One of them is to decriminalize personal possession, but also to make sure that access to drug treatment and evidence-based drug treatment will increase, and some of it will be paid for with actually cannabis taxes. So I think that this sort of holy grail for people who work in a space of drug policy reform is exactly what Oregon is about to implement. It regulated cannabis a couple of years ago, so it actually has tax money to do that, and then expand access to services and stop putting people in jail for personal possession.
At Decrim in Oregon and the legalization, marijuana legalization initiatives that passed all did better than either President Trump or Vice President Joe Biden.
We are now moving into this moment in the United States where it's no longer a partisan issue. Because when you look at the first states that regulated, it was very much sort of Democrat versus Republican. While right now, exactly what you're pointing out is showing us that this is no longer a partisan issue. There's an understanding that drug policies as they are simply harmful, and that needs to change, regardless whether you're leaning left or leaning right.
Why did it take so long?
The United States has always been sort of a pioneer in very conservative drug policy. For many, many years, you could have talked to politicians who, off the record, would tell you that, of course, they think it's silly, and of course, it's not productive. It was politically risky for them to speak out about it publicly. And I think those days are over. Our incoming president still is not convinced that cannabis regulation is a way to go, but he is slowly starting to recognize that the laws that he actually helped to put in place have caused, exactly as you said, a lot of pain, a lot of damage in people's lives. So while I'm not excited about the fact that he thinks that drug courts and mandatory treatment are a way to go, I'm glad to hear that there's some recognition that the state that we're in now, even with those changes at the state level, there's still a long way to go. And I'm hoping that he will actually help to move this at the executive level as well.
What's next?
There needs to be action at the level of U.S. Congress. While states are moving forward, the issue of banking has not been resolved. This is where federal government needs to come in, and Kamala Harris will be a great advocate for that. She understands that cannabis industry needs to be fully regulated, including have access to proper banking. Let's decriminalize, not in just one place, but many more. I very much hope that midterm elections, there will be efforts, additional efforts in the U.S. There's plenty of room for DOJ to start thinking about how to decriminalize at a national level. There's enough movement and enough examples that we can draw from to start moving all this into a national strategy rather than state by state.
Kasia Malinowska is director of the Open Society Global Drug Policy Program. About 70,000 Americans die from drug overdoses each year. And finally, a new poll shows low-income Americans overwhelmingly support government programs that could end poverty and hunger. Pollsters spoke with more than 800 adults earning less than $50,000 a year and found those living near or below the poverty line face multiple barriers to getting ahead, barriers made worse by the economic impact of COVID-19. Andrea Sears reports.
According to Joel Berg, CEO of Hunger Free America, more than half of the people polled faced three or more such barriers and said they want to see government policies that would make it possible to thrive.
Policies that would guarantee living wage jobs for all adults, make quality housing and health care affordable, and eliminate the benefits cliff that penalizes people when they work extra hours.
He notes the HEROES Act would provide relief, including raising SNAP benefits. It was passed by the House in May, but hasn't yet made it to the Senate floor for consideration. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand points out that with so many businesses closed by the coronavirus, thousands more New Yorkers are now lining up at soup kitchens and food pantries to get enough to eat.
We are the wealthiest country in the world. It is outrageous that we have so much hunger in America today. We have to end hunger in our lifetime. We have to marshal the resources and marshal the will to do the work to end hunger.
She is joined with Representative Joseph Morelli in introducing the HOPE Act, a bill she says would modernize and streamline access to benefits and services. Congressman Morelli says government agencies need to find more innovative ways to work together and use new technologies that can improve access to social services when people need help.
They don't need more bureaucratic problems. They don't need more red tape, especially now when we're trying to take every step possible to uplift families during this extraordinary time of need and to make sure that no American is ever left behind.
He says even in normal times, 25% of the working poor and 55% of people over age 60 who qualify for SNAP benefits don't receive them. I'm Andrea Sears.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry, Eileen Alfandary, and Andrea Sears. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.